To please the court, representatives from the Attorney General's office, I gave some serious thought to coming down today and making my argument go about two sentences. And while the court might appreciate that brevity, I think Mr. Chavez deserves a little more. I'd like the court to know that I consider it very much an honor to appear before you today and to have the privilege of making this argument on his behalf. I think the issue that we're addressing today is a matter of prejudice. The district court found a number of areas in which both trial counsel and appellate counsel were constitutionally ineffective, but found no prejudice. So there are really two matters in which we're submitting that there was prejudice.
Mr. Frisch, can I interrupt you just for a second before you, I want to hear your argument. In your brief, the first argument appeared to be a straight-up argument that it was error not to produce the DSS records. And I guess I was going to ask you whether that's even properly before us, because that's something I think could have been raised on direct appeal. I understand there's two separate arguments. One could be it was error not to produce the records, and the other is addressing that in the context of ineffective assistance. Is it the latter that you're arguing, or are you making both arguments?
I'm making the latter that it was ineffective assistance of counsel in that, first of all, trial counsel didn't get the records, the DHS records, into the record, make sure they were there. And appellate counsel didn't get them into the record, and so the Court of Appeals on direct appeal refused to address the issue. So, I look at it and I say, well, okay, so we have an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, and maybe the remedy is a new appeal, but then we kind of start all over again and say, okay, let's go back on appeal on the DHS records. I think it's a matter of conservation of resources that the court should consider that issue in terms of a remedy. And where we go with this. But I mean, in terms of presentation, it is effective in assistance of counsel for not getting those records up to the Court of Appeals. But I'm not asking for a new appeal. I'm asking that this court look at those records and say, yes, because those records were not tendered, it was a Brady violation, it was ineffective assistance of counsel, and the remedy should be a new trial, not a new appeal. Because I see it of no purpose to come back and relitigate the same issue. So that's the manner that I'm attempting to proceed.
Okay, so you really are arguing here that this issue in connection with the ineffective assistance claim, it's not a separate issue from should the court have produced the records. Am I understanding you correctly?
If you could restate the question.
Sure, and I apologize. I was confused in your brief, and this is on me, not you, that the first argument seemed to be you were saying it was error not to produce the records. And I would have a question as to whether that's properly before us now. You then go on and argue the ineffective assistance claim and not getting the records into the record. I understand the argument you're making on that. I'm just trying to be clear as to whether you are or are not arguing that it was error in and of itself for the district court not to produce the records.
Well, obviously that's a direct appeal issue that should have been addressed, but for the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And I'm just saying, as a matter of judicial economy, then I think this court, it would be incumbent upon this court to review that issue at this point now that the records are there. That's what I'm asking.
Thank you.
I really struggled with issues of prejudice dealing with 35Cs. I've just had an opinion come back where I thought there were numerous ineffective assistance of counsel, and the ruling against me was that there was no prejudice. This case is a little different because there really wasn't a great deal of evidence against Mr. Chavez. There was absolutely no scientific evidence. The only eyewitness that could identify Mr. Chavez was a boy who was age 9 when he testified, and he was a year or so younger when he witnessed this event. There was not any scientific evidence except some allegation of a small bruise in the neck shoulder area, and that's where we get to this issue regarding Dr. Gatto. Dr. Gatto examined this child 3 days afterwards, and he didn't find a bruise. And so I would submit that that's kind of goes to the issue of, well, when did this bruise occur? Because if it occurred 3 days before, from trauma 3 days before, then it should be, a bruise should be beginning to show more, not less, 3 days later when she's examined by Dr. Gatto. It was the defense that called all the CBI witnesses, not the prosecution. So in a case like this, I would submit that the amount of prejudice on a little on something like this magnifies. If there were a ton of evidence against Mr. Chavez, these issues might not rise to the level of prejudice. Since there was no evidence, only this child, who really was the one that resulted in the conviction of Mr. Chavez.
There was a passerby as well, wasn't there?
There was a passerby, but that passerby could not make an in-court identification. That passerby did not see Mr. Chavez with the child. And so I would submit that had that evidence been all there was, that there would have been no conviction.
What about the fact that that the court did read portions of the of Dr. Gatto's report, which in fact confirmed that there had been no physical evidence of trauma, that would suggest that there really isn't prejudice shown if that was before the jury?
Well, as I stated in my reply brief, I don't think this issue alone would carry my argument. That when you look at the closing argument of the prosecutor in this case, this is what he says. We are really without much information on the extent of Dr. Gatto's examination. All we have is a part of his report. Take it for what it's worth, but it doesn't contradict anything that anybody else has said. I would submit that reading a report is just not the same as live testimony, particularly in a case here where it's not like there was a ton of evidence against Mr. Chavez. So I think these small things elevate in their magnitude because of the lack of evidence that was otherwise presented.
Well, Mr. Fritchie, is your argument the difference between reading a report and live testimony, or was there something substantive that Dr. Gatto was able to provide at the 35C hearing that you're arguing should have been available at trial?
Both. And there were such things as, did the young child have pubic hair? And Dr. Gatto testified at 35C hearing, yes, he did. That would impact the likelihood. This was not a penetration case. This was a sexual contact allegation. And it was argued, went to the jury on the fact that both of them had their pants down, and yet there was no transfer of hair. And it would seem to me that with Dr. Gatto's testimony that this child had pubic hair, that that becomes a bigger issue than if she did not. That's just an example. And again, I would submit that the Gatto issue in and of itself probably would not be sufficient prejudice. But I think when joined with the DHS records, then there is ample prejudice to Mr. Chavez.
I ask you, Mr. Fritchie, on the DHS records, and I recognize, as all counsel in your position are, you didn't see him. So I understand you're arguing, but you know, a little bit blind, but you have to have some hypothesis for what you would find in those records. I saw a reference in the briefs or the record that information outside the DHS records showed MS had a tendency to lie. You're talking about outside. What did you expect to find inside the records?
The problem, Your Honor, and I think it's pretty definite here, I had to do two supplemental briefs because these records were provided to me. They were part of the record, and whether it was my ignorance or what, the Attorney General kept arguing that it was the court shouldn't let me see them. But I just assumed since they were there, and I read them. And that was my point number two. And I go back to, this would have been the second sentence, the old maxim from tort law is to look and not to see is to not look at all.
But what does that result in, having reviewed the records, which I didn't realize you'd reviewed the records?
Well,
is there something specific in those records that you think would bear on the issue of prejudice by the non-disclosure?
Absolutely.
And what did, I don't know, this is a delicate area, I realize, but.
Pardon me, Your Honor, I don't know how to object, but
can we shut the time, please?
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Yeah. I recognize it. We don't want you to disclose general confidential information, but is there some way to direct us or to make an argument as to what it would be?
What I offered to do when the Attorney General objected to my brief, saying that there were many, many references, and there were. I mean, I hyperlinked into those records many, many times, and then I was ordered to do a second brief, and then I did that, and then the allegation was, well, you're still making reference. I offered it, and it's within the file as an appendix, as a sealed appendix, my hyperlinked reference to these things, because you know, it's hard for me to argue something that's clearly erroneous when I can't make a reference to them, but all I can say is that they're there.
Let me suggest this, and it was interesting, both of my colleagues whispered at me exactly what I was going to say. Can we? I guess I'd like you to submit something in writing to us. You would write a letter addressed to the three judges here,
yes.
Indicating what documents you're talking about that you indicate showed, you know, some prejudice here, what would have made a difference. Tell me, since I have no idea how many documents you think we're talking about, we do it under seal. Please file it under seal. Tell me, I don't know, how many documents, how many pages do you think you need? Is it 5 pages would be enough in a letter to us?
Well, there are 462 pages of records, and there must have been probably 60 to 80 references that I tried to make in that first brief. And I would ask the court again to accept my request and my motion for this to become a sealed appendix to this record was denied by the court earlier. But I would renew that, and I will certainly abide by the court's request and probably make that request. I think they are hard to read. I spent a lot of time on it. Very, very difficult to read because they're in handwriting.
Okay. Well, we can take another look at that. In the meantime, would you be able to address or direct us to documents, whether by Bates number or date number or something, that you believe shows prejudice?
Absolutely.
All right. And could you do that in a 5-page letter, just giving us some heads up on what you think would have changed the result?
I think so.
All right.
Certainly, and if I'm having trouble with 5 pages, I'm guessing I could maybe request maybe.
Yeah, well, why don't we do this? Why don't I give you 8 pages?
Okay.
And how long do you need to submit that to us?
The problem is I'm planning a trip out of town at the end of next week, and I don't know that I could necessarily get it done confidently before that, so would 3 weeks be asking too much?
Okay, that would be all right. So 3 weeks from today, whatever date that is, we'll have that due. And we're going to Mr. Kayla, how long would you need to respond to that?
Our position, Your Honor, is that it's entirely improper for either counsel to be looking at those records at all. This court deals with reviewing sealed records on a regular basis and has expertise in doing that. The records are sealed for both parties. The fact that the trial court messed up and provided it in the record, I think it's not a waiver of the confidentiality records, and we think that's, well, we object to the procedure.
And this was already litigated, you say, in the motions. I was not aware of that. There was on this court.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Ritchie's filed 2 briefs where he referred to the records both times. The counsel in the case objected to those briefs, to the references, both direct ones in the first brief and more veiled references in the second brief. And both times this court struck those briefs and ordered counsel to file a brief that did not refer to those records.
All right, let's do this then, and I appreciate the professionalism of both of you in raising these issues with the court. I think what I'd like to do is give us an opportunity to look at this, and we'll issue an order. So for now, you're off the hook, Mr. Fritchie.
Okay.
We will issue an order as to whether we want or don't, or think that we can't really look at a supplemental brief, but let us take a look at that. Were we to go ahead and grant it, we'll give you the 3 weeks, and if we were to go there, Mr. Kaler, you need 10 days or 2 weeks, or what do you need after that? I'm not suggesting we are going to do this, I'm just don't want to have to contact you after if we do this order.
All right. If we do it, then, Your Honor, it'd be 2 weeks, but I'm sure my directions to attorneys in this such case like this would be we would not respond at all.
All right. I appreciate your courtesy in that. In the meantime, let me ask both counsel not to do any further with those records. Don't look at the records and let us take a look at them, and we will issue another order and the division, as you probably both know, these, the preliminary issues go to a motions division, and so where the division is signed. So give us a chance to look at that, and we will issue some sort of order either way and let you know what we've decided. So again, I very much appreciate the professionalism of both of you and your sensitivity to these records. So
part of my argument is that this was brilliant material. The prosecution had an obligation to not say, well, it did hit me on the head, so I didn't provide it. I think the prosecution had an obligation to go look at these and see if there was Brady material. I would submit they would have found it. And I've argued in this court that I think the Attorney General, as being basically prosecutors, also have that obligation to disclose if there's something there that would, in fact, be Brady-type material, and I would submit that it's there. The prosecutor made the following argument in closing statement. When he's talking about the testimony of this young child, he goes, I submit this is a pretty astonishing thing to make up for a child at the time he was making an initial report to the police officers. Had this evidence come out, he wouldn't have been making that argument. And that's a powerful argument to a jury who's thinking about their own children. It's like, my kids don't know about this kind of stuff. And sure, if they come to me and say, you know, I saw my sister getting raped, and give any kind of detail, they're going to say, well, they must have seen it. And so this was powerful evidence against, and powerful argument against Mr. Chavez that shouldn't have been made because of the fact that the Brady material should have been provided. And I'm down.
Mr. Fritchie, do I understand the record correctly that the jury did hear some evidence about the credibility of that witness?
There was a lot of evidence about the credibility of that witness, but nothing was what it could have been. I mean, the prosecutor impeached this child quite a bit and used it to get in prior inconsistent statements. I would like to reserve my time unless there's another question.
That would be fine.
Thank you.
And there was some colloquy in there. We'll give you 3 minutes and 30 seconds when you stand back up.
Thank you.
We wasted it, took it, not wasted, we took at least a minute every time. Mr. Kaler.
May it please the court and counsel. Paul Kaler, 19210 for the people in this case. Again, it raises this issue, and not to beat a dead horse. As you know, I'm here to represent the prosecution, or not the, I'm representing the conviction in this case and the trial court's order in this case. I do not represent the Department of Human Services. I know they would want to, if the court were to order, still continues contemplating ordering any sort of briefing on the contents of these records. I request that before the court does that, to issue an order to the parties to first brief out whether they should be given opportunity to look at this, because the Department of Human Services has a great interest and a very important interest in maintaining the confidentiality of these records, and I think their counsel needs to be at least given an opportunity to weigh in on this important issue. This is actually why I'm here, to make sure we did not, because of the history in this case, not to refer to these records and to make sure that anything got shut down. So people request that before even giving parties an opportunity to brief any sort of anything concerning the content of this question, to actually order responses on whether that should be done at all.
Understood, Mr. Kaler. Thank you for that. But let me ask you, so separate, putting that aside, you do agree, I assume, with Mr. Fritchie that we as a panel can look at these records in camera ourselves?
Oh, sure. Yeah, this court has expertise in doing that. It comes up from time to time. I've done it a couple of times in my career. This court knows how to look at them, and I don't know what's in the record. I don't really have any opinion either way. This court looks at it. This court knows what Brady material is. It knows what impeaching evidence material is. It knows what is discoverable and what is not. This court can do that. Can look at that. I was reviewing the direct appeal opinion from this court on this case. I thought there were a couple of holdings this court made that may be relevant to that. To your determination. One of the issues on direct appeal was the issue of whether if the brother had seen some sort of sexual activity involving, since sexual activity at all, quite one of the questions raised on direct appeal was whether that was relevant evidence. At trial, the trial court held or found that that was not relevant evidence, and on appeal, this court held that that evidence was not, because of the nature of the brother's testimony here, that evidence was not relevant, or at least the trial court had not abused its discretion in finding that evidence not relevant because of the very limited nature of the brother's testimony.
In other words, let me make sure I'm understanding. I think that the argument appears to have been that the DHS records might show that this young child had particular sexual knowledge that he got based on some prior experience that the DHS records may reflect, and that may have influenced his testimony here. And the response was he didn't need any particular sexual knowledge because all he said was he saw this man with his pants down on top of his sister.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's one of the issues that this court addressed on direct appeal, and I think under basic law, the law of the case principles that should control here, assuming, and I have no knowledge, assuming there was any evidence of sexual activity in or sexual knowledge in the DHS records. So making a law of the case argument concerning that. Assuming there's any evidence concerning competency in that material, again, that was another issue addressed by this court. This court held that because the trial court had examined the brother prior to trial concerning his level of competency, it did not matter. That was done. Therefore, it would not matter whether there was any information in these DHS records concerning his competency because it was done live in front of the court, and the trial court had superior position to make that determination. Again, another thing, it was in our briefs too, was the brother's testimony was attacked. The credibility of his testimony was attacked a bunch at trial. If there is any evidence in the record concerning his credibility, our belief is that it would need to be of a highly serious nature because in order to not become cumulative to the evidence that was presented at trial. He had made inconsistent statements, things like that. That was fully examined at trial in the cross-examination and in the redirect. So if there's any credibility-related information in there, our argument is that it would have to be highly important in order to not be cumulative. Concerning a physician's testimony, whether the victim had bruises on her shoulder or not was either a minor or even less than a minor issue at trial. All three medical people that examined the victim said that her private parts were normal. That was the key issue there, whether she had bruises on her shoulder that faded over the course of a couple of days or a couple of weeks is a minor issue or no issue at all.
Mr. Kaler, my understanding is the report was read into the record?
It was read into the record.
And was the date of the report or date of the examination told to the jury?
I can't remember. It's in our brief. What the trial court read to the jury was in the thing. So I think that was, I think it was set forth, but you can look at my, or look at our brief and see. Again, also concerning the direct appeal, there was an issue concerning whether the trial court abused discretion in denying the defendant a continuance to have this doctor testify at trial. And this court held that there was no actual prejudice to the defendant because the jury heard this report. So again, I think that is another law of the case principle that applies in this case.
Do you have any response to your opposing counsel's argument about the DNA evidence could have been tested?
I don't know anything about that as far as the trial, Your Honor. I have no opinion on that. I think that's all I have. Again, I know the court would do this, but before ordering any sort of briefing on the contents of these files, please give us an opportunity and the Department of Human Services, their attorneys, a chance to weigh in on this issue because it's a very important one. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kaler.
If I get the rest of his 8 minutes.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
I will try to speak quickly within the 3.5 minutes I have. That were the two sentences that I was going to make to this court. One, the prejudice issue becomes very different sliding scale here because there wasn't much evidence. And two, please read these records. Please read these records. And particularly, there's one that was entered right before trial that I think was of major significance.
We'll look at them, Mr. Fritchie, and I know you've got limited time, but I want to make sure I mean, having been involved in ADT, I think I know the way this is supposed to work. I did not know you'd seen these records. Generally, what happens is you make some sort of evidentiary hypothesis as to what you're likely to find. The court then reviews the records in camera and says yes or no, and then they're put in the appellate record for us to look at as the way it normally works, and then we do a review and you never see them. That's the way it's supposed to work, correct?
I'm learning that.
Okay.
The hard way, I did this opening brief three times, but the Court of Appeals on direct appeal did not address this issue because they said the record is not here. We cannot address it. So it hasn't. And there was a de novo review on direct appeal where they said, no, there's nothing here. This is a judge that I will appear in front of again in Weld County. But I just don't sense that he actually read these records, certainly not with the intensity that I did.
But we can fix that. So we look at the records and let's say hypothetical, we were to conclude that there was something in there. Would we then decide, how does the prejudice inquiry work at that point? We find something the court should have disclosed. What happens from there?
Because there was essentially a lack of evidence. He was the only witness other than the passersby that really couldn't. I mean, it was a slight confirmation of his testimony, but in and of itself would not have convicted Mr. Chavez. I think these matters that might not have swayed the court in other cases should be of much greater magnitude in this case. And I think I addressed this in my reply brief under the doctrine of judicial economy. Rather than send it back for a new appeal and go through this regimen again, I think this court should basically, if it agrees with me, then reverse this conviction and set the matter again for trial.
But in other words, we, in your view, we would make a determination of prejudice as opposed to remanding for to have the trial court make that decision.
Yes, because the trial court states, I've read these records, and even though I find ineffective assistance of counsel, I find no prejudice because there was nothing in the records that the defense should have, and I would submit that the Brady material is, in fact, there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fritchie. We thank both counsel for their arguments and, again, for their sensitivity to these issues. The court apologizes for its own, or I'll take responsibility for my own lack of understanding of that part of the record. So we apologize. We will look at it. We'll issue an order. We heard both counsel and understand what we need to do. So we thank you both for your arguments and your briefs. The case will stand submitted. We will get an order out in due course, and then, depending what happens from there, a written opinion will issue after that.
So there will be an order before an opinion, or?
Yes. Yes, we'll get an order out before.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you both.